The first bill we have today is House Bill 2317. Ms. Mowat.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2317 would define conviction for certain purposes, specifically in criminal cases. We've actually seen this issue come up a few times on specific statutes. I am thinking of our public indecency bill that the committee heard a few weeks ago, where the statute was changed to include comparable out-of-state offenses. What this would do is add to the criminal code sort of a catch-all provision that, unless a statute otherwise specified, when a statute says that a person has been convicted of an underlying offense, that conviction would be assumed to mean out-of-state convictions as well.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Skinner.
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Gina Skinner, and I'm a representative of the Oregon State District Attorney Association. I'm a deputy district attorney in Washington County. And this bill is more of a catch-all provision, just as was described to the committee. There are a number of statutes that currently in the criminal code do not have this language. This has been a trend that I've seen over the last 10 years. That we have created many statutes that have been aggravated to a felony if they have a previous conviction for a same or similar offense. Sometimes when those specific statutes were drafted at the time, language was just simply omitted because most likely the people that drafted it weren't thinking of the consequences at the time it was drafted. But then when people in the district attorney's organization are arguing for these particular convictions in court, judges and juries can be confused about whether a previous conviction in another jurisdiction would in fact aggregate this to a felony or not, and that has been left unclear. There are a number of statutes, one of which is the Felony Assault 4 Statute 163-160, the Felony Stalking Statute 163-732, as was just mentioned, the Felony Public Indecency Statute 163-465. The one that's later going to be on this particular hearing this morning, the House Bill 2361, even specifically addresses this issue in the DUII revocation license statute that talks about if you have three previous DUI convictions, the fourth one will be, we've had problems with this over the last 2 years because before this issue is going to come up later today, the statute simply said that the third time of a DUII, the fourth one would be a revocation. It didn't specifically address if those other DUIs were out of other jurisdictions. The other one that I specifically recall is in the Oregon Evidence Code under 609, subsection 2, subsection A, where if you have, you're impeaching a domestic violence defendant offender, you can use previous domestic, specific domestic convictions to impeach that person's credibility. That particular statute doesn't mention whether those previous convictions can be out of another jurisdiction. So the idea is so that statutes that have previously been drafted and ones that would be drafted in the future that to address the same issue if it gets left out by omission, by accident, that if somebody is from another jurisdiction and moves to the state of Oregon and they have a number of these convictions, that they are now going to be a resident of Oregon. If they commit that crime here, we also want to treat them the same way we would have if that crime had been committed here, if the elements match up and they're the same crime.
Okay, thank you. Questions? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a consistent interpretation that's applied where the to references now that are made to convictions without indicating whether it's in or out of state, or is it piecemeal as to out of state?
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, I believe that it's piecemeal, that it is not consistent. I would imagine that many judges want to err on the side of caution and would not allow that previous conviction, but I would imagine that jurisdictions would have different interpretations of that because there are some statutes that specifically say that other jurisdictions would apply, that one could argue that the ones that where it was just left out because no one had contemplated it, that it was meant to be left out. And we are leaving it into the statute as this is drafted, that if the intent is to leave it out, then that would be written in, that it would be left out. But other than that, any previous conviction with the same elements would be treated the same here in the state of Oregon.
Follow up, Mr. Chair? From what you just said, it sounds like there are some instances in which the prior convictions go to evidentiary questions, like could a prior conviction be used to impeach a witness? And in other instances, it elevates the penalty that's applied for the offense that's being tried. And is there any pattern in which its prior convictions are treated as including out-of-state convictions as between those distinctions? That is, I'm focusing particularly on the elevation of penalty because that has potentially a fiscal impact. Is there a pattern in which they're either included or not when you're looking at the level of penalty applied?
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, do you mean, is there a pattern in the manner in which the statutes have been drafted up to this point? Or
no, I'm sorry, I should clarify. That is, what you told me a moment ago is that there's no consistency about whether prior convictions are counted or not. And it's kind of case by case. And so what I wanted to know is, focusing on that area which has a fiscal impact, that is, elevating the penalty that's applied for the offense, is that area of application generally including out-of-state convictions, or is that also hit or miss, case by case?
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, I honestly don't believe that I can address that issue because I don't know how all the jurisdictions are currently interpreting it. From what I have seen, most judges are being... There, like I said, there are some statutes that specifically allow for this, and so obviously that's addressed. The other ones, it is very unclear. We go into court and we make arguments about why it should apply because there's some case law that talks about, like in sentencing guidelines, for example, that previous convictions when determining where someone falls on the grid is you do take into consideration other states' convictions and that there's a series of case law on that, but that doesn't specifically address where we're aggravating the underlying crime to make a crime a felony. And so that is sort of left unclear. I would imagine that if this is added in, that then it would be clear that those other states' convictions or municipal courts or federal convictions would aggregate and make a case potentially a felony where it previously was a misdemeanor. That could add some amount of fiscal impact because then at that point, if there was some unclarity before, that it would be clear in the future and those cases would be felonies. If courts were being, if they were looking at it and not wanting to add that when they were not sure if they could, then it would be an additional cost.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Was there anybody else who was going to testify on the bill? I'll accept a motion. Or go to work session.
Mr. Chair, I would be uncomfortable moving this bill out without seeing a fiscal on it, because what we've just heard is that there's not a consistent pattern about whether prior convictions are being counted or not, and to the extent we're then adding out-of-state offenses in the grid of sentencing and thereby upgrading the penalties, that's going to have a fiscal impact because we're going to be putting people in prison longer. So I'd be uncomfortable acting without knowing what the dollar impact is.
Okay, then I'm going to close the work session. Yeah,
and maybe that we staff would have an idea when that information might be available to us.
I would expect that we could probably have that by the end of the week. I would also expect, just so you know, Representative McPherson, that the fiscal will likely be an indeterminate fiscal impact, just because that's what we've been seeing on, for example, that public indecency statute that we have, the bill we've already heard that where it specifically lists an out-of-state conviction and elevates it, we got a fiscal on that. It was indeterminate, and I would expect probably a similar result, just so you're aware of that. But I can have that, and I can just reset it for a work session next week and ask fiscal to have that for us.
Okay.
We'll do that. Okay, we will get a fiscal on that and then come back, so we'll close the public hearing on 2317. Next bill up is House Bill 2360. Open a public hearing on that. If the Pratts and Ms. Skinner could come up for that, please.
As these witnesses are coming up, Representative Barker, I did want to point out that Ms. Howe is passing out at this point some written testimony submitted by Gretchen McKenzie, who is a legislative analyst on the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. She is not going to be speaking today, but did want this written testimony entered into the record.
And will you give us a brief?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2360 imposes fines and mandatory imprisonment for persons convicted of driving under the influence of intoxicants if the person had 0.20% or more by weight of alcohol in their blood of the person at the time of the offense. What this does is already, as I'm sure the committee knows, if you're a 0.08 or higher, you are considered to be driving under the influence of intoxicants. A first-time offender is looking at a minimum $1,000 fine, or I'm sorry, a first conviction. This obviously would exclude persons who have already participated in a diversion program. A first-time conviction would require a minimum fine of $1,000. Second conviction, $1,500. A third conviction or greater, $2,000, as long as there's not an imprisonment or an extended period of incarceration there. Additionally, there are requirements that a person would spend 2 days in jail or an equivalent amount of community service time would be ordered. That is something that a court cannot suspend by statute. This bill, if a person is 0.20% or more, would change the fine to a minimum of $2,500 regardless of a criminal history. It would require the court to impose 7 days jail as opposed to the 2 days jail or community service. And if the person had been convicted of a DUII in Oregon or another state within the last 5 years, it would require a minimum jail sentence of 60 days. And that jail could be served in a local jail, a minimum security facility, or inpatient rehab or treatment centers.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Bruce Pratt, for the record. I'm a member of Crime Victims United and on their DUI committee. I'm here today speaking on my own behalf and on behalf of all Oregonians and the drivers, passengers, and their loved ones. Any person who insists on driving with a BAC of 0.20 or more is in complete disregard of the lives of you and I, and is beyond having the control of the vehicle. Our son was killed by a driver with a 0.19. After the crash, even though the driver was not injured, he could not stand up. Testimony at court showed that the driver was a seasoned drinker, and yet his motor skills were in such disarray that walking was not possible. Seasoned drinkers or hardcore drinking drivers are usually people that are encountered at this high or elevated BAC. A definition of hardcore drinking driver is one who repeatedly drives with a 0.15 or more BAC and who continually drives after drinking. Let's see, 2003, there were 207 deaths caused by DUI. On a weekend night in the United States, only 1% of the drivers have a BAC of 0.15 or higher, yet drivers with a 0.15 or higher account for 65% of all drinking driver fatalities. Or to state it another way, a driver with a BAC of 0.15 is 300 times more likely to be involved in a fatal crash than a sober driver. 40% of all fatal crashes involve alcohol, but for fatal crashes occurring between midnight and 3 p.m., that rises to 77%. We must also remember that first-time offender is first-time apprehended. Most experts agree that the average driver cited for DUI has driven impaired an average of 1,000 times before being caught. These experts also agree that the impaired drivers persist in their behavior because the people believe that they won't be caught or convicted. Well, the obvious question is, why do drivers who have been arrested, convicted, and lost their lives, and perhaps served some time in jail, continue to drive and to kill innocent motorists? Most of these hardcore drinking drivers can be classified as problem drivers or dependent on alcohol, and some have personality problems that include aggression and hostility that are added to their involvement with alcohol. These people need special attention and higher sanctions. We must remember the cost to society. 1.1 million of the costs are economic costs, and 75% of those costs are shared by you and I in added insurance costs for auto insurance and health insurance, higher taxes we pay for police protection, and for road delays that are caused by crashes. Why are we so lenient with intoxicated drivers? In any other instance of causing 207 deaths each year, it would create a huge uproar from society. A person with a BAC of 0.20 is a crash with death or serious injury waiting for a place to happen and must be stopped from driving. I support House Bill 2360 and urge forwarding this bill to full committee and to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Good morning, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Ann Pratt. I'm a member of Crime Victims United. I'm also a MAD Lane County board member and a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUI. I am in full support of House Bill 2360. I'm in support of enhanced penalties, sanctions for extreme DUI. There are, according to the study that I read, there are 9 other states that have increased sanctions that are placed at 0.20 BAC, and there are 31 other states that have a degree, and they do vary, but of increased sanctions. I brought with me 5 cases. They're all repeat offenders. They've all ended in death. This one was 2002. It happened in Jackson County. The drunk driver, an intoxicated driver, had a 0.20. He killed one and injured 4 others. The victim's name was Jane Tallis. The drunk driver was John Gesch. The second one was one that actually happened in Douglas County. He had 3 priors. His BAC was 0.24. He killed Dennis Zucker. His name was Todd Michaelbrust. This one I thought was probably the poster child for the reason that we need to crack down on drunk driving. It happened in Clatsop County. He was also a repeat offender. He was only 21 years old. His BAC was 0.28, and when he was arrested at the scene after he had killed Ruth Genther, he made a remark similar to, "This woman dented my car." His name is Kalen Jeffrey Painter, and he was 21. But I believe this one really takes the cake and has to be the poster child for me. This one just happened in Jackson County. The offender is John Patrick Bush. 11 years ago, he killed David Buchanan and just recently has been convicted of killing Andrew Baker. His BAC was 0.296. These are just a few of the people that we find on our roadways today. Obviously, they don't all end in death, but we share the roadway with these offenders on a daily basis. And please, for the sake of public safety, I urge you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Gina Skinner, and again, I'm representing the Oregon District Attorney's Association in support of House Bill 2360. We've heard a significant impactful comments regarding the specific situations where high BACs have turned into deaths of innocent Oregonians on our roadways. This particular limit of a 0.20, as we can tell, is more than double the legal limit. The more you increase the BAC, the more you increase the impairment. This bill would do a number of things. It would increase the deterrence for people to be driving at high legal limits. That would reduce the number of accidents and number of injuries by, in addition to the deterrence, also increasing the penalties. These people, because of the higher risk, should be penalized further than the people because of the high BAC. In addition, by the increased jail time, it increases the amount of time that this person will be off of the road and will be unable to be driving during that period of time and causing any risk to other innocent individuals. Finally, the proportionality makes sense. On a second DUII in this bill, the judge would be required to give the person 60 days in jail. That's currently not happening. I can't speak for all counties, but it's not uncommon for somebody to get a second conviction and to only serve a couple of days, maybe a week at most, in jail. Currently, under Oregon law, a fourth DUI conviction, as we've heard before, is a felony. And if you have no other criminal record but for the previous DUIIs, you are looking at a presumptive 13 to 14-month prison sentence. If you have the equivalent of three felony persons' convictions on your record, you're looking at 25 to 30 months in prison for a fourth DUII. So as far as proportionality goes, it is not unreasonable for a second conviction for somebody to serve 60 days in jail and to have that be mandatory, especially when the risk is so high to the public with a high BAC. I do have one specific issue that I would like to address to the committee, and that's regarding the language in the bill that talks about the 0.20. I would suggest that there be some language in the bill that addresses at what point that 0.20 is measured. There is some language in the implied consent statutes that talks about that the 0.08 for purposes of suspension of the license is determined at the time of testing. All the numbers that were given to the committee, I assume from the other people that have testified here, those numbers come from when the person blows into the intoxilizer. That's how we get that number. To avoid further litigation that the 2-0 would be at some other period of time, we would ask that the language be, there would be some specific language about that would in fact be a presumption that the person was a 0.20, so that we don't have to bring in experts to extrapolate backwards in every single one of these cases for that sentence. Other than that, the state would be, or the Oregon District Attorney Association is in support of this bill.
Thank you. Do you envision that with this bill, if somebody, I come in, I'm convicted of that, that there would be a pretty good chance that a lot of the district attorneys would make plea bargain offers to just plead to regular drunk driving?
I would be surprised, Chair Barker. Currently, as I know that Your Honor, or excuse me, Mr. Chair Barker, that you are aware that there are statutes that prohibit the district attorneys from plea bargaining DUIIs away at all. Someone cannot plea bargain to dismiss a DUII and convict them of something else. I would be surprised if that sentence would be plea bargained and that would be something that would similar to the current fine structure that was put in the last, I believe the last legislature or the one before that, as far as the 1,000, the 1,500, the 2,000, that's my experience. That has never been used in bargaining that I have participated in or that I have seen, and that's purely left, the person is just pleads to the charge that's charged, whether, you know, the DUII, and that the sentence would be left up completely to the judge to address.
Well, you think the reason I asked that when in past years there was a separate crime of driving .15, and frequently those were just traded down. I mean, I'm not,
Chair Barker, I can imagine that if this statute, if this legislation was specifically set up to create a separate statute, like the misdemeanor assault for felony assault for, that it was like DUII and then aggravated DUII, there is potential there that that could be used as a plea bargain to plead down to a regular DUII. But because this is going to be within the same criminal statute, they're just going to plead to the crime of DUII, and that this issue purely goes to sentencing, which in many counties is not really plea bargained. It's just completely left up to the court to make that decision, similar to this, to the increase in the fine structure. I would imagine that would not be done.
Thank you. Further questions?
Ms. Skinner, I'm trying to understand what you just said. The measure summary says the bill would require the court to impose a 7-day jail sentence, that's for a first offense, and if there had been a conviction within the past 5 years, would require a minimum jail sentence of 60 days. So is it discretionary with the court whether they would, if the evidence showed a 0.20 blood alcohol level, as to whether or not they would apply that, impose that jail time, or is this, in effect, a mandatory minimum?
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, the way that this is drafted, I would have to assume that it would be mandatory, indicating that a court must impose and not suspend the execution sentence of the imprisonment of the time structure that's listed there. Currently under the law, they're only required under a first conviction to serve 48 hours in jail or 80 hours of community service. Between that and when they commit a felony, There is no other requirements as far as time. So you can commit a first, second, third, and there's still no other time that a judge under the current law is required to give the person for their sentence but for that 48 hours.
Okay. Follow-up, Mr. Chair. It's my impression about at least some parts of the state, and I'm thinking particularly of Multnomah County, where there's been a real problem with recurring property crimes, that there's insufficient bed space to house offenders who are doing repeated burglaries, for example, and that people are being released even though they should be incarcerated for a longer stretch of time. They're being released almost immediately, as this was the often observed complaint. And I'm just wondering how this fits in with that process. That is, does this mean that if somebody had a prior DUI conviction and then was caught with a .20, that they would be required, that there would be no discretion for the judge, and that person would stay in for 60 days, and that more people who are burglarizing houses on a repeat basis would have to be released sooner?
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, I'm going to address this in two ways, one of which is that the bill, the way it's drafted, it indicates that the sentence shall be served consecutively unless justice requires otherwise. There are circumstances that many counties have work release programs on the weekends where they can come in and serve weekends in the jail, so the time would not be conserved consecutively, or they would it indicates if justice requires otherwise. I'm not sure what circumstances that would be. The second point I'll make is that this requires the judges to impose the sentence, and the judge would impose the sentence on the judgment. What the jail does with that sentence is another issue. Each jail has their own matrix and their own criteria for when they hold people in custody, when they release people. They may have internal rules. They may have specific counties. May have a judge. May have an order that requires certain crimes. They have to do certain things. But even though on any other sentence a sentence is imposed, many times a particular county, because of the jail space, may force release that person early. They may have community sentence options, such as wearing a bracelet and being within the home, or having home detention, or having a work release center where they go during the day and they go out to the community to do community service and other home programs. Some even have programs within a work release center that has inpatient alcohol and drug treatment options available. Every county, unfortunately, because of funding, has a variety of different options available to them to what they can provide as opportunities or as a sentence for defendants. This bill would simply require the judge to impose the sentence. What a particular jurisdiction creates as their priorities for their jail would be a county-by-county basis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Jeff Ross and Paul Snyder.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Rost, and I am a member of the Oregon State Police Forensic Services Division. I come before you again this morning with both written testimony and oral testimony, and the intent is to simply summarize my written testimony at this point, and really to make three, I guess, points, if I could. The first of which is that we do think that implementation of House Bill 2360 will result in some fiscal impact to the Forensic Services Division. And the reasoning is twofold. One is that we would anticipate that there would actually be more contested cases going to trial as a result of enhanced penalties coming from an enhancement of mandatory fines, mandatory prison sentences in cases where the blood alcohol concentrations exceed 0.20. Specifically, just to kind of give the committee some statistical information, the average blood alcohol concentration in the state of Oregon, as measured by our breath testing instruments, is approximately a 0.15 or a 0.16. So we're not that far away from the 0.20 threshold. The about 13% of the cases that the blood alcohol cases, or excuse me, of the arrests that are made in the state have blood alcohols of 0.20 or greater. The second point that I'd like to make is really kind of building on one that Ms. Skinner referred to previously in her testimony, is that as the law is written right now, we read this to be a at the time of driving offense as opposed to at the time of test offense. And what often happens in current prosecutions, particularly those cases that are near the 0.08 threshold, is expert witness testimony is requested upon on the part of the state or on the part of the defense to come in and argue based upon a drinking scenario, amount of alcohol consumed, timing, whatever, that either the blood alcohol of the defendant was above or below the legal limit at the time of driving, regardless of what is demonstrated by the test result. Because the construct of the language in this statute is similar, we would expect that there would probably be a similar burden placed upon expert witnesses to come in and testify at the 0.20 threshold as well. And so we would expect not only to see an increase in the number of cases that are actually going to court and being contested, but we would likely see an increase in the number of cases that would require expert witness testimony in order to do retrograde extrapolation and things of that nature. So those two, excuse me, Those two issues lead us to believe that there's likely going to be a fiscal impact to the Department of Forensic Services, and I submit that to the committee for their consideration.
Thank you. Any questions, the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the subcommittee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and I have similar testimony to that from Mr. Ross, and with respect to the questions that Representative McPherson has already raised, and that is the fiscal impact, well, organizational as well, impact on jails. We have overcrowded facilities in this state when it comes to jails and to prisons. We have a number of county facilities that are mothballed, aren't being used at all, simply because we don't have the resources to provide for the staffing levels to operate those facilities. There are conversations that are going down now in the Public Safety Subcommittee on Ways and Means to see if perhaps it would be appropriate for the Department of Corrections to rent space from county jails rather than to engage in further building of state correctional facilities, because we have quite a few empty county jails that we can't operate. The witness from the District Attorney's Association mentioned that the existence of caps on county jails. There are triages, processes that the county jails use. Many of those processes are dictated by federal court decree with respect to the capacity of each county jail, but others are created by the counties themselves. And that is to say, when we have someone walking in the front door and we don't have enough room for that person, who's going to be moving out the back door? And it's a process that's based primarily upon risk to the public safety. So the last people to leave the county jail facility are the ones that we think are the most dangerous to the public. A couple of years ago, Senate Bill 1145, some of you know this number already, some of you may not, but Senate Bill 1145 was the legislation that in 1995 said to the counties, we'll work something out with you. We want everybody who used to serve 12 months or less in the state prison system to now serve at the county level. And that was funded by the state. One of the population drivers was a group of that 12-month or less offenders that were subject to structured sanctions. And this is a process whereby the parole and probation department would say to an offender, look, you violated your probation, and you can go to court and take your chances before the judge and the district attorney, or you can allow this department to let you cool off for a couple of days in jail. It's your choice. What do you want to do? And in most of those cases, the offender would go with the structured sanction imposed by the parole and probation department. Well, a couple of years ago, that population began to decline significantly. And the Department of Administrative Services, Sue Porter, who does these population projections, took a look at that population to try to understand why is it going down. And she concluded that in the larger counties, that was the place where the population reduction was occurring most, and the reason why it was happening there was because of constrictions in local funding. In other words, we couldn't operate the jails at full capacity. We had to reduce the population, so the sheriff would say to the parole and probation department, don't impose such long stretched sanctions because we don't want those people in this facility. We need to have room for the others. The point of all this is to just simply say that we have a facility capacity problem that's driven by budget constrictions, and it's not going to get better in the foreseeable future. But I want to close by saying to you that I sympathize very much with the Pratts and with the purpose that they wish to achieve by this legislation. I wish we had the resources in order to accomplish that purpose, because there's a lot of carnage going on out there that really should be addressed by this society. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Mr. Snyder, I think we all agree with your last statement, absolutely. It's the kind of conduct we're dealing with here is very serious misconduct, and we need to try to do what we can within our resources. What I was focusing earlier and I wanted to return to is, how does that decision get made This bill, as currently drafted, would say that there's a, in effect, a mandatory minimum sentence to be served, either 7 days or 60 days, depending on whether one had a prior DUI. And the judge would appear to not have any discretion, as the judge would have to impose that sentence if the fact of a .20 was found. Is then the decision about who gets released, who actually serves their sentence, is that a separate decision that's made by whoever's the superintendent in charge of the jail for the relevant county? How does that process go forward?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I think the answer to that is it depends. In situations where there has been a lawsuit in federal court, the federal court enters a decree. That decree often would include a triage process in the decree itself. So it says when you reach capacity, you will release offenders until you're back down to the designated capacity created by this court, and you release them based on this order of priorities. In counties where those decrees don't apply, there is a triage process that can be created at the local level, and it's usually done in conjunction with the presiding circuit judge and with the district attorney and the public defender or the defense services folks. And there's a collective corporate process that somewhat reflects the decree of the federal courts when we go to federal court. But I think, and I'm not sure of this, Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, but I think in most cases they would be hard-pressed to release somebody who's got a minimum sentence. Now, perhaps the witness from the District Attorney's Association probably knows this better than I do, and if she knows better than I do, I would ask her to just correct me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Guy.
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we oppose House Bill 2360. I'd like to preface my comments by saying that I'm not here to say that people who blow a 2-0 don't potentially deserve a greater sentence than someone who blows a .08, or that on a repeat offense that they shouldn't get a higher sentence. What we object to is the idea that you want to make it mandatory within a statute. Mandatory sentences, in our opinion, are generally never a good idea because there's always going to be somebody who didn't deserve that. There's always going to be a circumstance where a judge feels that that person shouldn't have that sentence. It may be that they're, from out of state and they've already gotten themselves into a treatment program in their other state, they work full time, they have children, and to be in the state of Oregon to serve those 7 days isn't particularly necessary. I mean, I could go down the list of possibilities why a judge may find reasons not to impose the 7 days. But what's most important is that judges can already do this under current law, and in my experience, do. The glory of a misdemeanor for the judge and for a prosecutor is that you can get more jail on a misdemeanor than you can on C felonies under the sentencing guidelines, and that is because the maximum sentence is a year, and a judge at sentencing can order all the way up to a year for whatever reasons they want, and reasons that don't necessarily need to be proven to a jury under Blakely. So if a judge sees a person come in with a .20 on a second offense, and especially if they have other criminal record or are unwilling to try treatment, in my experience, they're going to get an increased sentence. So I don't think it's necessary to tie judges' hands and not to allow them to sentence a person to what they see fit. And I'm not hearing here that it's a problem that judges aren't willing to sentence people accordingly. We come here every legislative session and hear about the stories of drunk drivers, and it's a problem, but it's not a problem that's addressed by this particular law. There are a couple other problems with this law. by placing this extra emphasis on 0.2%, you're drawing a bright line, and I'm not an expert, but perhaps Mr. Rouse could confirm this, that will disproportionately impact women and people who weigh less, because they reach 0.20 much faster than a bigger person. And so to draw a bright line is, it takes away the ability of the judge to take those things into consideration. I have had women who are not drinkers who went out drinking after work with people from the office. They drink the sugary drinks. They reach a much higher blood level faster. That's not to say that they're not more dangerous on the road, but because they're not a drinker, they may not be such a danger for a repeat offense. And they've been 2 days in jail for someone who's never been to jail before and is not a drinker has a significant impact. And those other 5 days are days that you're paying for that you didn't need to pay for. So those are the kind of circumstances I'm talking about. And judges need to have the discretion to impose the sentences that they think are appropriate. They are doing that job. We also hear a lot before these committees about people who refuse to blow in the breathalyzer. Well, a bill like this creates an incentive not to blow on the breathalyzer, because if a person is savvy, which I'm not saying that most of them are in my experience, people who are arrested for crimes are not that savvy, but if they are savvy and they're going to take into consideration the penalties when deciding whether or not to submit to a breathalyzer test, this bill increases the incentive not to take that breathalyzer test in order to avoid the mandatory jail sentence. The other point that I wanted to make in terms of fiscal impact, I think that most of those fiscal impact arguments have already been made, but it's important to remember that there will probably be a fiscal impact in terms of just trial time and litigation. Because under Blakely, because this is going to increase the sentence and it creates a mandatory sentence, this likely will need to be proven to a jury, which means that, as Mr. Roust testified, there's going to need to be an expert to come in and testify to, whereas in a jury trial for DUI, they may not need an expert to come in and testify if you've got a .20. It's pretty clear to the jury that you were over 0.08. There's not a lot of wiggle room there, but if you're a .20, there is going to be wiggle room. You are going to require more experts, and there's going to have to be a special question to the jury for them to make that finding requiring the mandatory sentence. All this money spent for something that judges can already do, already have the discretion to do, and in my experience, already do. They sentence people according to how drunk they were, what their criminal history is like, and what is the evidence that they really have a drinking problem, and that they really do present a danger of reoffense, a future public safety danger. So I think that you need to leave these decisions in the judge's hands.
Thank you. Ms. Guyon, I've seen people who have been through all kinds of different levels of drunk driving, and sometimes people who are at a point of weight would say, I thought it was okay to drive, but I mean, somebody that's too old would have to know that they shouldn't be driving. I mean, they may drive anyway. They may say, I can probably get away with it. But, I mean, would you agree with that or disagree? Or
Chair Barker, having never been in that situation of, you know, I can only tell you from talking to clients, and I'm thinking of, you know, the specific client I'm thinking of is the woman who was not a drinker and went out after work and drank all the sugary drinks, and my impression from speaking with her, unfortunately, is that by the time she was a 2-0, she wasn't thinking to make the decision of whether she should be driving or not. She was thinking that she needed to get home because she needed to relieve the babysitter who had her kids. And that's the problem with 0.20 drinkers, is that they're beyond the ability to make that decision. And, you know, that is a very bad thing, but I'll tell you, that woman served 2 days in jail, and you will not see her in the criminal justice system again, because she learned a very valuable lesson. She was very humbled by the experience, and I'm sure successfully completed her probation. But, you know, talking with someone like that is a different experience than talking with some of your other drinkers who you know,
right.
Can drink to a 1.5 on a regular basis.
I have a question, Mr. Chair. Did that particular client already have a diversion completion, or did she refuse diversion?
That, Chair Barker, Ms. Maud, you know, I can't remember. Actually, I think that there was another, my recollection is she wasn't eligible for diversion because there was another charge, and I can't even think of what it was. It might have been, I can't remember.
Okay,
thank you.
Thanks. Okay, thank you. Well, this bill has some problems, not least which the fiscal, and then the language to clarify when the blood alcohol would count. So I'm going to ask Ms. Mullen to do a little work on that. We will not go to work session on this one today. The next bill up is 2361. And again, Bruce Pratt and Ms. Skinner and Paul Romain. And Ms. Lloyd, you want to give us a rundown on that, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2361 has been suggested to be just a housekeeping bill, really. In 2003, during the legislative session, this particular statute was amended, and it was specifically addressing a person who was a third-time offender by saying that a person who was a third-time offender would have their driving privileges permanently revoked. Presumably, although I was not here during the 2003 legislative session, the intention was to include a third or subsequent offense. However, the sentence simply said a third time. Since the session, this issue has been litigated, and some courts have very strictly interpreted the statute so that if an offender is in front of them for a fourth, fifth, or greater DUII offense, they have not been permanently revoking their driving privileges, and instead say that since it is not their third time, that they are not to be permanently revoked. So my understanding from the proponents of this bill is that this is really housekeeping to achieve the initial goal, although persons who passed this law in the 2003 session know what their initial goal was better than I do.
Mr. Chair, before you even start, just got done talking about having discretion of the courts, and that's why you can't give courts discretion. They don't have any common sense. This is a good example of it.
Thank you, Chair Krieger. Yeah, apparently they learned their English language from somebody other than somebody different from me. But Mr. Pratt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Pratt. I'm a member of Crime Victims United, but I'm here today speaking on my own behalf. I'll be very brief. As it has been pointed out, House Bill 2361 is a refinement of the language of last session's 2885, House Bill 2885. Anyone who has received three DUI convictions is considered a habitual offender and should not be allowed to drive on the roads. That person has shown no regards for the lives of other drivers and has not changed his habits. Please advance House Bill 2361. Thank you.
Thank you.
Gina Skinner from the Oregon District Attorney Association. This bill, House Bill 2361, appears to do three things. As was previously mentioned by counsel, this is a housekeeping bill, and this, again, is an example of what I testified to previously on House Bill 2317, where language just simply gets left out. That's not necessarily the intent, and so the first thing this bill does is what I addressed previously in 23 in the previous bill of 2317, that it adds the language of or its statutory counterpart. Previously, this suspension bill only said that on your third conviction of specifically said of driving under the influence of intoxicants under ORS 813.010. And again, the language was not in this bill that for its counterpart. There should not be a benefit, and I'm addressing both bills now, that for when you are out of state and you come to Oregon and you have, whether you are a transient person, you've lived in a number of states, you've had multiple convictions in a number of states, you should be treated the same, whether you're in Oregon or anywhere else, and you should not get a benefit from running away from your troubles and coming to Oregon and continuing to commit more crimes. And so that's the first fix, is that if you have two convictions of DUI, say, in the state of Washington, you come to Oregon for your third, that will be a revocation under this bill. The second fix is, as was previously addressed, that the bill simply said for the third conviction, and we're just asking that that be third or any subsequent conviction. We had many people that already had three convictions, and then when they got their fourth conviction under this bill, under the law as it was before, the courts were not ordering the revocation because that was their fourth conviction and not their third. The final thing that this bill does was in the subsection 2, it talks about when the time period would begin that a defendant that was convicted of this could apply to reinstate their license. This is basically saying a lifetime revocation, but there is a provision in here that after 10 years, there's a process under which someone can apply to a court to have those license privileges reinstated. From reading this bill, I can only assume that in the previous legislature, the assumption was, as Representative Krieger had just mentioned, that judges would, in fact, impose the presumptive sentence. Under current sentencing guidelines in the state of Oregon, if you get a felony DUII, you must have three prior convictions. The sentencing guideline structure sets out that two DUII convictions for the purposes of sentencing of a felony DUII are considered person's crimes, which makes your presumptive sentence on a first-time felony DUII conviction in the state of Oregon 13 to 14 months in prison. The maximum under the presumptive sentence would be 25 to 30 months, as I previously testified. One can only imagine that when this was originally drafted, that we assumed that the judges would in fact give that presumptive sentence so that everyone had a felony DUII would go to prison. Because it talks about here that the timeline for when one could apply to get their license reinstated would be after they were released on parole or post-prison supervision. But what's happened is that there are a number of judges that will downward depart, which means that they give the defendants probation for a fourth time DUII, a felony DUII conviction. They have the discretion whether to give them any jail time at all, and they get probation. There was nothing previously in the statute that addressed that issue as far as a timeline, and all this adds is that they must have completed probation, and then the timeline for the 10 years begins, so that those people can be captured in this revocation statute. And that is all that it's doing. That's what that section of the bill is addressing. The Oregon District Attorney's Association would propose that all of those are just fixes, and that is we would support this bill, and it's a classic example of why we would also be supporting House Bill 2317.
Thank you. Any questions? Mr. Romaine.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association, and I think you can see by the three people up here who are supporting this bill that it does have a pretty broad range of support. I support this bill, would encourage its passage. The concept that you can have a couple of DUIs in another state and come here and get a third and not be subject to this is ridiculous, and I'm sure it was a drafting error. However, in defense of the drafters and the fact that the chair is now gone, you have to be very specific when you do draft, and judges are supposed to literally see what the law says and interpret it, and you know, you can't really fault the judge for maybe some bad drafting out there. So, but this does correct the problem. Speaking of bad drafting, what I would suggest you do before this bill goes to the floor is correct the measure summary of the bill, because it seems to give the impression that this is the bill that requires for the first time this revocation for third or subsequent convictions, when really all you're doing is correcting a little problem there. I would correct that because, as you know, some of your colleagues do not really get much farther down than the measure summary when they're voting on something, and I would strongly suggest for passage purposes that you revise that measure summary a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. And this guy.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Kelly Skye on behalf of OCDLA again. And I initially came here we were not going to take a position on this bill, but in looking at it, I do want to point something out. In subsection 2, the portion that adds in or has completed probation, the way that this will work, it will end up punishing a person who was placed on probation more than the person who was sent to prison, and I think that that's it's not fair to the person who was placed on probation, and may not be your intent. So I just wanted to point out the time-wise, and I did speak with Ms. Skinner about this before the hearing, and she agreed with me that I'm correct in my interpretation or my analysis that the person on probation will be without their license for longer than the person who's sent to prison. This is a problem because, you know, I don't know what judge is putting someone on probation for a DUI, but if they are, they are departing downward under the sentencing guidelines, which requires that the judge make a finding of substantial and compelling reasons. That meaning that this the judge is looking at this person and saying, this person, for whatever reason, does not deserve to go to prison. I'm going to put them on probation. That probation period is a standard length of 3 years, can be all the way up to 5 years. Under this bill, the person's license is revoked for 10 years. Then they have to wait for the entire probation period, 3 to 5 years, on top of that. So they've lost their license for 13 to 15 years before they are even eligible to apply for reinstatement. Whereas the person who went to prison, even if they had a bad record and they got a 30-month sentence, when they are released on parole after 30 months, they are eligible for reinstatement to request reinstatement of their license. They're eligible to request that earlier than the person who was placed on probation. And if you think about the reasons why a person's placed on probation rather than sent to prison, you've got your more serious offenders going to prison, but you're punishing your less serious offender who was put on probation more. So I think that that is unfair, and it's disproportionate sentencing, and I just wanted to bring that to the committee's attention.
Okay, what would you suggest as a remedy for that?
Well, I think that you can either leave it out the way the statute was before. That person is still revoked for 10 years. It's just a matter of, do you want to add additional time on top of that? Right now, the person who goes to prison, the additional time they have to wait is the amount of time that they're in prison, because their 10 years doesn't start clicking until they get out. On the person who's placed on probation, you know, you can either leave it out and make them eligible for request for reinstatement in 10 years, or you can make it upon release from any jail sentence imposed as a condition of probation. Is the only other wording that I can think of. I mean, and that may only be the difference of 90 days, and whether that's worth all of this, I'm not sure. But I just wanted to point that out.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you. I don't think I'm going to move this to work session today because of the suggestion on the summary. So we get that straightened out. I'll have Ms. Moore work on that. and we'll bring that back. We'll also consider Ms. Guy's input on that as well. But I expect that to be back fairly soon so we can get them moved out. And as probably a lot of people know, that was still was my bill last time, and I was surprised to learn that some judges weren't enforcing that. We're interpreting that differently. We had made it clear enough, so we do want to make that clear enough and get that back into swap. I'm going to take a real brief break, about a 5-minute break, and we're going to be back.
Okay.
Issues work session on House Bill 2015. Representative McPherson, do you want to talk about the
right? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had asked staff to look at what the practice was in other states on the statute of limitations for sex offenses, and I was imagining there might be more coherence to it than there is, and it. In fact, it's highly variable, as it turns out, and we don't have a complete 50-state survey because it was taking quite a bit of time. But it gives, I think, the an indication of where other states are. Some of them have essentially no statute of limitations for prosecution of sex offenses, so it could be any amount of time. Others have rather short ones that aren't told until after the victim turns age 18. So that the generalization that staff shared with me is that Oregon is probably now within the sort of the bulge of kind of averaging these statute of limitations, or a little on the lighter end, shorter end, and that it, with a 6-year addition, we would probably be still within that bulge, but toward the later end. Mr. Chair, it's my intention to vote against moving the bill today, not as a firm resolve that that's where I think we ought to be, but to register some reservation, and it's really based on a principle, which is that it's not just the concern about the need to protect the public by prosecuting that's important. It is that there's the purpose of a statute of limitations is to make sure that we're doing justice by making sure that the factual background is not too old and cold. And when we extend statute of limitations longer, we're increasing the amount of time that's elapsed from the relevant events until the prosecution goes on, making it that much more difficult to make sure that an offense actually occurred and that we've got the right person who's the perpetrator. So in recognition of that reservation, I will be voting against moving the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Representative McPherson. Take a motion.
On the other hand, Mr. Chair, I would make a motion to move this bill, House Bill 2015, to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. It's been moved that we move the bill to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
We'll move with the bill.
And who will carry?
I have Representative Olson carry. No further business. Meeting's adjourned.